especially the guys that are working that have become so successful. I can argue now Florin Crenshaw is the most prominent golf course architect duo in the world right now. There are shapers and guys that are working on the Kapalua project and built places like Sand Hills and Friar's Head and some of the best courses in the world. And now here they are sort of wanting to come back to Hawaii and fine-tune Plantation Course, which is already the best course in the island. So I think it says a lot about Hawaii and golf in Hawaii and how much this project really meant to their career.
Absolutely.
Build dreams in today's world where we have such unstable climates and there's of stops in playing alone, it's become harder for the recreational golfer. And so that seven combination you don't want to have. You want it the other way around. And so what's going to be able to deliver that type of playing is firmer conditions, and the sand-based greens are going to do that.
Awesome. The first green, you were talking about the veterans may lose a little advantage on the green, and then you brought up one of the greatest putts that you've ever seen. Tell us about this first green. I mean, that's a really important green, and it's certainly the history of
it. Really is. That green is, there's a big stand of tall cook pines behind the green, and so the green is never as perfect a service as the other ones. It doesn't get the afternoon sun, and you see very few putts made on that first green, and I'll never forget, you know, it was the first tournament of champions of the century, 2000. It'll probably go down as the greatest finish of the entire century on the PGA Tour of the entire century, I believe. Because if you think about it, Ernie Els came to the last hole that day, tied for the lead, he made it legal, and he lost. So think about that. But what happened was Tiger had hit his approach shot on the first green. He was about 45 feet behind the hole, and Ernie was inside, and Ernie was about 30 feet. And it was a hard putt that Tiger had. It was a putt that looked like it's downhill, but the mountain was in the distance, so it was really kind of uphill, and had a couple of different breaks to it. And I was standing right down there, and I heard Ernie Els from walking by say to his caddy, Ricky Roberts, hey, let's just two-putt and go to the next hole. This is a tough green. And 10 seconds later, I heard Tiger say to Stevie Williams, I can make this one. And sure enough, Tiger made it. And that was almost the beginning of the end for Ernie when it came to beating Tiger. He never really challenged him seriously again in the rest of his career.
Well, I mean, you know the attitude. It's all
it's
in the mind, right? Let's keep
this
in that mind.
To make it. But that green now is going to have a different slope to it. So people that have done it on that thing for maybe 10 years, in the tournament champion, they're going to see a different green. It's not going to have the same kind of slope.
Interesting. So they're going to be challenged on a lot of different levels, not only because it will be a better test for the players, but it will also look completely different and completely different. And this is going to be fun. I can't wait for next year's Century Tournament of Champions. Speaking of Tiger Woods and putting, he wishes he could make some of those 40 footers in Riviera on Riviera. It's been tough.
Yeah, it has been. I must say, watching Tiger the last couple of days, he has looked 43 years old. I think after all the surgeries he's had and everything he's been through, cold weather, he's never been a good bad weather player anyway. But he looked like he was fatigued to me. He looked tired. And the first thing that goes when you're in that sort of a situation is your putting. He just doesn't look sharp with the putter to me. And he's still hitting the ball reasonably well, and I think he's fought hard, you know, he's going to make the cut now, it looks like, with a real incredible late birdie, a long putt to do it, which is just vintage Tiger Woods, but I think that cold, damp weather is just a toll, especially on his putting.
Yeah, well, 8 hours on the course, and the guys in that flight, you know, that part of the starting times, really had a hard time, because I was watching Jordan Spieth, he's way up there on the top of the leaderboard, and that's just the first part. He hasn't finished round two yet, so all guys are finishing round two, and they're at the top. So that's really why it's so hard to follow this and know exactly where everybody actually stands.
Yeah, we're waiting to see what everybody's scores are like about noon tomorrow when they're getting ready for the last round, and then you'll know. You know, you hear players complaining about getting the wrong size of draw. You know, that happens at Wildlife sometimes. It'll be windy on Thursday afternoon and then windy again Friday morning, and people will say, oh, it's way better to go early in the morning on Thursday and late on Friday. But, you know, you got to look at your whole career, I think, for a player like these guys, because in the end, they'll all even out. And if you start focusing on, oh, woe is me because I got the wrong end of the draw one week, you're going to be in trouble.
Tiger joining WGC Mexico. Surprise you?
It surprises me a little bit. You know, I still thought I should have come him taking the big break that he took. You have heard me say in the past when he wasn't eligible for since they turned over the champions and he ought to play Wylie. I still think there's a day he could go to Wylie. I think it'd be a wonderful course for him. He would make every putt out there, and he wouldn't have to try to overpower it. I think he could play all those short old dogleg holes fairly conservatively and not take a big toll on his body and blast away with these young hitters. I just thought once he was eligible for Century Tournament Champions, he should have started the year here and not taken a break. It's too long a break between this tournament, which was the first week in December, and San Diego. That was almost a two-month break. That's too long if he's going to stay sharp and competitive.
That's a really good point, to stay sharp and competitive. Do you think he'll play Honda?
I don't know. You know, he looks to me like these tournaments now, you know, are wearing him out. He plays a couple in a row. So if you play L.A. and then go to Honda and then go to Mexico, I would think it's likely he won't play Honda. I'm not really sure. I would like to see him play more, but I don't think 3 weeks in a row is the best thing for him, especially, Daniel, with the stretch that's coming up. If you think about it, you have Bay Hill, which he likely will play because of Arnold Palmer and being in Orlando. You've got Players' Championship. Did that have a week off Tampa, but he nearly won that last year. Then you have another WTC in Austin the week after that. And 2 weeks later, you have the Masters. So if he looks ahead to that stretch, he's going to have to play a lot in there, which means I don't think he will play.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And speaking of Mexico, and we'll go back to that, Matt Kuchar apologizing now and saying he's going to pay the caddy $50,000. This was so surprising to me. This whole way it started, it made Matt Kuchar look... I was shocked when he said, the guy's making $65,000 a year. He should be happy to get $5,000 for a week. One week worth of work. I'm like, whoa. Everything you said up to that moment, I could handle. That moment, I don't know how you sleep good at night.
Well, I'm with you. I think that's what caused him to issue the apology yesterday, was really taking a look at what he had said. But the other thing he said that really bothered me was he said that someone must have gotten in David's head, the caddy, and told him that he hadn't gotten enough money. Well, Matt wouldn't have known that because Matt never called him up. If Matt would have called up the caddy right away and talked to him and said, hey, do you have any?
I read the whole thing. I hope you can find it online. But it
he wasn't on social media during that time. He was basically estranged from the world, just loving Hawaii the way he and his family do. And I think he became a little oblivious to the situation and just how serious it was. Had he gone back and played, let's say, in spring that next week, it would have been, you know, at the forefront, and he would have dealt with it earlier. But yeah, I think he didn't. Because he was sort of isolated out here in the
aisle. Maybe, no, that makes more sense, you know. Yes. But it's the heart that hurts. You know, the heart of it. Boo Weekly, on a much happier note, Boo Weekly is like, where's Boo been? Well, he's back. It's PennyWeb.com. Cancer in the shoulder, tumor in the shoulder area is what I heard.
Yeah, you know, everybody's getting older. That's one thing that nobody can change. And Boo's the kind of guy that he's not going to tell you if he's got a problem with his shoulder. In fact, he probably didn't tell his doctor for quite a while. No, Boo. I look at that guy. He's a tremendously talented guy. And my thoughts and prayers are with him for beating this cancer, which I think he will. But, you know, how is he going to beat Justin Thomas? That's what I can't figure out. You know, Boo Weekly, as soon as the fall comes, he all he wants to do is go hunting and fishing and live his life the way he always had. And his talent was able to, you know, get him a couple of wins and be fairly successful on the PGA Tour on a limited basis. But the way the game has changed and the way these guys are preparing and you know, playing week in and week out all over the world, I don't see how Boo Weekly is going to beat Justin Thomas. If they go play 10 times, Boo's going to be on one.
You know, I know Justin Thomas, watching him in that weather, just drop those putts one after another. And
because they didn't want to risk some manufacturing tolerance coming into play and accidentally going over. What TaylorMade's done is kind of the reverse. They've intentionally gone beyond the limit, the legal limit, and then they inject a resin into the face to slow it down to where it's just under the limit. So they can control that injection of the resin far more than they can the construction of the overall head. So those two little blood orange ports you see on the face, on the heel and the toe side, that's where the resin gets injected. They bring it down, they CT test it, make sure it's within the USGA parameters, and they're good to go.
And that's the speed injected to his face.
Correct.
Got it. So, speed injected to his face. Twist face came out last year. So the M5 and the M6s, do they have new names with this new injection technology?
Yeah, it's basically the same twist face technology that was on the M3 and the M4 drivers last year, except now they have added the injection technology in there to speed up the face. They've also changed the weight track on the bottom on the M5 to where it's more of a T-track with a track along the back, whereas before it really didn't quite have it in that way. So it gives the people the opportunity to use the adjustable weights in more configurations than it previously could have.
Now, if you went out and bought yourself an M3 or an M4, and now, you know, a year later, twist face, now has injection, I can understand why they want to offer some incentive to people to, hey, you know, we'll take your training to give you this, this latest and greatest, this better model that we've come up with. $50, but the question that I really need to ask you is the handicappers, what are these clubs designed for? What handicap?
Well, there are a couple things, and I always think trying to fix golf clubs by handicap is a little tricky because you can have a very strong 28 handicapper, and you can have someone who doesn't swing as fast who's an 11 handicapper. So I think it really boils down to more swing speed than handicap, although certainly if you're a higher handicapper, you probably want more forgiveness. So the M6 model, which has a much greater forgiveness factor than the M5, would probably be a better club to look at in the TaylorMade family, or go to the Ping G410, which is one of the most forgiving drivers on the market. But in terms of what these can do for you, the M5 allows you, it has match adjustability. So if you like to tinker, if you like to try to alter your ball flight, say you're fighting a bit of a hook and you want to try to mitigate that, well, you can move all the weights out on the toe. That's something you can't do with the M6. But if you're fighting a slice, the M6 comes in a draw bias version called the D-Type. That might be a better model for you. So in the TaylorMade family, a little more skilled player, higher swing speed, someone who wants to probably manipulate the ball flight a little more, they should look at the M5 or the M5 Tour. The player looking for a little more forgiveness, a little more help getting the ball in there, M6, M6D type is probably more their style.
And you know, you're on the inside. How soon do you think they'll come up with a better version of a driver? Will it be every year there's a better version? It kind of gets frustrating.
Yeah, well, as I tell people, it's probably the question I get asked the most often. Is the new stuff really better than last year's stuff? And the answer is yes. It certainly is. That said, are you going to notice it if you bought the M3 and then you bought the M5? Are you going to notice a monumental difference? No, you're probably not. If you bought a driver last year, it's still perfectly good this year. But if you haven't bought a driver in 3 or 4 years, you're going to notice the difference. You're going to see the difference. That's kind of my criteria for purchasing new equipment. There's some people who always want the latest and greatest, and so if they bought the M3, they want the M5, and the opportunity to trade it in is a great avenue to help mitigate some of the pain of that. But, you know, for the people that you're talking about that feel a little frustrated, don't feel frustrated. businesses. The bottom line is, just like any consumer product, pretty much, they're going to try to improve it every year. So if after 3 or 4 years you haven't made an investment in a driver, perhaps it's time to look at that. But don't feel bad if you have last year's model. You still have plenty of horsepower in that club.
Excellent. Not just about wedges. On the gold side, we have Cleveland, two Cobra, Mizuno, plus Callaway, Titleist, and Dynamite. I made the top marks on the hot list. So let's go with Cleveland first.
Yeah, I think Cleveland's really interesting in what they've done with their wedges. And their two wedges are really considerably different. So you've got the RTX4, which is, you know, the better player's wedge, one that a lot of tour players are using, and it's got a very clean look to it. It's got a very, kind of rounded shape, but it's just kind of a better player shape to it, and it has a number of options in full grinds and bounce types, and I think that's, you know, for the better players, it's really in tune with how they attack the ball and how they, you know, what type of turf conditions they're playing off of. The RTX4 gives you a myriad of options to work with, and, you know, some general rules for people that don't understand, you know, bounce or grind is, if you play off a very firm turf, you probably want a little less bounce. If you play on very lush turf, you probably want a little bit more. Or if you're very much a digger, you probably want a little bit more. It just helps you plow through the turf. But their other wedge, the Cleveland CBX, they made a very compelling argument to us when we met with them. And that is that 84% of golfers play cavity-back irons, you know, mainly because they like the forgiveness of that. So why wouldn't they want a cavity-back wedge, which also offers a lot of forgiveness? So, we took that into very high consideration. It was an argument that made a lot of sense. You know, they also have a lighter shaft in it, again, for players that maybe aren't quite as skilled. So what they did is they took game-improving features from their irons, put it in a wedge, added a sole grind that they felt would fit the majority of golfers, and kind of made the process for buying a wedge a little simpler for those who maybe are not in the single-digit range.
Excellent. Now, Bill also has two wedges on the hot list. Are they also different?
Yeah, they are, but not as much. That is really more of a look. As you can tell, you know, one of them is kind of fat finish. One of it is a black finish. The primary difference between the two is on the 2.0 stealth, there's a half groove just above the leading edge on the higher loft, which gives you a little bit more contact area with the ball for a little better spin on those real short shots. And also by not having to paint the face, the groove area increased by about 30%, so a little bit more grab on that. And I think also a number of players just kind of like that black finish, which reduces the glare that you don't have to look at.
Yeah, it's cool, too. It's so much a part of it, the work, the way it looks like to the player.
Well, you're a golfer, and you know, right? If you like looking at something, your confidence factor goes up. And you tend to make a better pass at the ball, whether it's a driver or a wedge or a putter. Confidence standing over the ball for everyday golfers is a big part of the game.
Let me ask you about Callaway, just because there's Phil Mickelson out there playing, and it was a big part of the wedge process with Callaway, I understand?
Well, absolutely, and in particular, the PM grind, which is obviously named after him. Phil was a big proponent of the old Ping I2 lob wedge, which is so popular with a number of players for its ease in getting out of bunkers and, you know, those flop shots and shots around the green that Lefty's so adept at. So he was a big part of the design factor in that. So I've actually had a lot of people ask us, well, why did that get a silver medal on the hot list? And, you know, the fact of the matter is, silver medals are, a lot of people think that's, you know, well, they're not as good. It's not that they're not as good. It's that they tend to appeal to a more narrow audience. And in the case of the PM grind, it's kind of got this high, tall face with a high toe, and it's a kind of a unique look that not everybody is going to fall in love with. So it's a very good golf club, but it's going to appeal to less players than, say, the Matt Daddy 4 line would.
Yes, I got it. That's so perfect. You guys do great work. This is Mike Johnson. Mike Johnson is Golf Digest senior equipment editor and, of course, a member of the Honda's team. And they work a long, long period of time, months, days, and then it boils down to a couple of weeks. So really, you guys get into real good conversations about which one deserves how many points and which one was anything very close this year.
Oh, boy. Honestly, Danielle, it gets closer every year. The discussions are earnest. The differences are slight. I think our final sanity check is always when we assigned all the scores and we see where everything shakes out. We kind of look at the list and say, we look at kind of the bottom of the gold and the top of the silver and say, does that club belong with that group, or does it really belong more with that group? And, we just kind of press ourselves to make sure that the decisions we've made, we feel confident that we can defend them. We have very lengthy conversations with the manufacturers afterwards. They all want to know how to do better. We had one last week that lasted over 2 hours with one manufacturer. It wasn't ugly by any stretch. It was just them wanting to understand the process as much as possible, what the feedback was, and how they could do better. And we welcome that, and we try to be as transparent as we can in our process. We know that manufacturers, you see Callaway, counting their 20 for 20 star rating on the driver, which was well-earned, and there's an element of calling the baby ugly here if you don't get 5 stars across the board, and we understand that, and that's kind of why we take the process so diligently.
Well, we haven't covered irons or putters. Maybe you can check in with us in a couple of weeks, maybe 2 weeks or so.
I am happy to come on anytime you need me, my friend.
Thank you so much. This is Mike Johnson. Mike Johnson is Golf Digest senior equipment editor, Hot List team member. Have a great weekend. A lovely long one, I hope.
You too. Thank you.
Aloha. We're going to come back and talk with Diana DeLucia. Her magazine is her baby. It is absolutely
Greg was in field by my new art director, who did change things up a bit. His name is Tim Oliver.
Excellent. Nicely done. I know what really struck me was I was going through some of the recipes, because not only do you get to go on journeys, and we'll talk about some of the journeys that are covered in this magazine, but you'll also get recipes like the duck confit, no aldi, and the pumpkin stout-based beef short ribs, and the pan roasted oregano salmon. And when you see the recipes that they're when you can, it starts with everything. It has everything that you can do at home. With the process, though, when you realize how much work goes into each one of these dishes, and then you can go to, Golf Kitchen Punta Rica in April, and have somebody just prepare these things for you. It's just wonderful what you're putting together, Diana. On the cover of the magazine is Francis Mallmann, ambassador at Garzon Club. He cooked for George Bush. This man has been around.
Yes, Francis Mallmann, he's a legend in the chef world, similar to Daniel Ballou or Thomas Keller in Argentina. And he's well-traveled, he's man, well-respected by chefs all over the world. And I was absolutely honored to be able to sit down with him for half an hour. It was beyond my wildest dreams.
When he was cooking for George Bush, did he talk a little bit about that experience?
Oh, you know what? We've got our stories mixed up. Francis Mallmann, he is the cover story, the Argentinian chef, and we're talking about Matthew O'Connor from Bonnie Bryer Country Club in New York State. Don't worry about that, because Mallmann probably cooks for every president in existence, so that's okay. let's go back to Bonnie Bryer. That said, Matt O'Connor is an absolute hidden gem of a chef. I was so impressed with his talent, his passion for his work, and I couldn't believe I had never heard of him before. And he's cooked at the White House, he's cooked the president, he's just a very quietly spoken young man, and he's spot on with his culinary. His talent is, I can see him on the rise in the future.
Where is Bonnie Bryer?
Larchmont, New York.
Is it, I don't know, is it a club? I'm not familiar with it.
Bonnie Bryer, it's an older club. It's not too far from Longshot Golf Club in New York State. And Bonnie Bryer, quite the history. The clubhouse is, beautiful. The golf course is absolutely stunning. And I do believe they're doing a lot of renovations there as well, and they're putting a lot more time and effort into hopefully a new kitchen for Matt. And he's also working on some educational programs for his staff, to give them more opportunities.
That's excellent. So we have Francis Mallmann on the cover. Matt Connor is featured in the magazine. Plus, Esther Sanchez, a restaurant chef at the Aramara restaurant at Four Seasons, Punta Mita. What a smile she has.
She's lovely. Everyone loves Esther. I did believe Esther actually came over here last year on a trip after Punta Mita. She had made some friends over at Wingfoot, and I think she did a little tour, and hopefully we'll see her at Punta Mita cooking. I'm not sure if she's not in our lineup, but I'm pretty sure she'll be there.
You're talking about that she may be at Punta Mita?
Yes, well, she is the Aramara is the restaurant, one of the restaurants at the Four Seasons at Punta Mita. And we're hoping that Esther will be at Golf Kitchen Punta Mita cooking.
You've got the executive chef, Bobby Persico, the host chef for the event, executive chefs and teams from Sibonic, Glen Arbor, Cassie, Keto Law, Sanctified, Edgewood, Bosque Real Club in Mexico City, Garzon Club from Uruguay, all going up, plus guest chefs, including Jose Carley from Puerto Rico. It's going to be an amazing event. It's 3 days, and you can either stay, play, because there's 2 days of golf. course, I was talking to Anthony. Oh dear, Anthony's name just went out of my mind. Help me.
Villanueva.
Thank you. Well, the following on this page is I'm on a wonderful cruise along the coast of Mexico, just having a wonderful time. I said, how do you get all these chefs and all of these, chefs have egos, how do you get them all in the same area, the same area, just carefully? Okay, so we have the Edison Reserve, Boca West Country Club, Edgewood Country Club, the Garzon Club, Glen Arbor Golf Club, Maya Comet Golf Club, Medina Country Club, and Punta Mita, Riviera Marriott, Mexico. What a stellar lineup. Have you been to all of these places?
Yeah, I have, and I've just met amazing people on my journey, and the chefs and the culinary talent. It's just like really cool to see people really improving the culinary landscape in the private club industry. It's changed so much in the last 8 years. It's just the bar has been set, and chefs are really making a statement in the industry now.
That's wonderful. Diana DeLucia is Golf Kitchen founder, editor-in-chief, publisher. She just came back from Maya Kama, where there is no cell service on purpose. Is that correct?
Well, I didn't have any. I was relying on my Wi-Fi the entire time I was there, but it was a joke of fresh air because I didn't need to, take any junk calls for the entire day. I was there for 4 days, so I didn't have any junk calls to answer, which was fantastic because I get so many of those annoying things. It's stunning. I wish everyone could go there and play and have a caddy. That was the best experience. I played golf and I had a caddy, and I actually learned a lot. And I think it's the best I've ever done on the golf
course. When she was at Maya Kama Golf Club in Sonoma County, California, so it's not that far away. Some of these places you're taking us to, I can't wait. I just got photos of the Garzon Club in Maldonado, Uruguay, are absolutely stunning. So for golf and food fanatics, 500-plus page coffee table book, histories, interviews with owners, general managers, sommeliers, executive chefs, executive pastry chefs, and recipes, accompanied with full-color photography of the golf courses, the clubhouses, the portraits, and of course, the food, because Diana DeLucia is an award-winning food photographer. Diana DeLucia, thank you so much for all you bring to us. Golf Kitchen Magazine, the new book, your travels, your journeys, and taking us with you. Obviously, we travel with Diana DeLucia. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you. Aloha.
Aloha. We're going to come back and talk to a gentleman who is also taking us vicariously on journeys. Maybe Michael Patrick Shields would like to go to Golf Kitchen Punta Mita in April. Maybe you can do the show from there. We'll see. He'll be on right after. Sandy Hall Tucker. This is the Golf Club.
Them in a number of places throughout Italy, and they've never let me down.
I love it.
anything or want anything, and so the president could really let his hair down around him. And I was sitting just outside his office right now, Ken Rayner, in fact, and he works here at, he's the head professional at the Coral Creek Club in near Bunker Branch, Florida, and just President George W. Bush, the 43rd president, was just here for a month. And so they lunched together a couple of times, and the president came out here and played golf. And yes, indeed, one of the things we were talking a great deal about is that there was a gathering of athletes for the viewing at the president's funeral back in December, and Ken was one of, I think there were 13 or 14 people who were invited to come for a personal and private viewing at the Capitol building there, and some of the others in that small group were Fred Couples, Jack Nicklaus, Peyton Manning, Hale Irwin was there, and Phil Mickelson, of course, and Jim Nance was in that group too, and they were all there together. There's a picture on his desk now of them all standing on the Capitol balcony. Apparently the president, you know, he was very involved in planning, as all presidents are, what their funeral will be like, and so he selected a number of athletes who befriended him over the years and made this opportunity available for them. So they went to the Capitol together, and they had dinner together afterward, just talking about their pal that they'd been up to visit in Kenny Bunkport. And that is all, many of those stories of the people that I just mentioned are in that book I call him Mr. President, which is Ken Rayner's book that I was lucky enough to collaborate and write with him.
Yeah, you spent many weekends at Kenny Bunkport with President Bush and his family.
Yeah, and I would tell people right now, it's selling out fast, but we are having the tournament again this year, the George Herbert Walker Bush Celebrity Fundraising Tournament. It's U.S. Open weekend. And our featured guest this year will be Nancy Lopez, Hall of Fame golfer. And so every year we have a couple of different fun people come in to celebrate. And if you're interested in coming out, there's a gala and there's a charity tournament. I'll be there broadcasting and doing some emceeing and that sort of thing. And the golf club where the Bushes play, Skip Arundel, is available. It's not private. It's semi-private. So you can go play there if you want to.
Where do we sign up?
Just Google it. There's a Facebook page, or I think it's georgebushgolf.com, if I'm not mistaken. But if you just Google George Bush Celebrity Golf Tournament, Kenny Bunkport, it'll pop right up, and it benefits the Portland Hospital there.
Fantastic. That's another thing on Google. You know, you can put something funny together, and it'll find something. It'll get you to your destination.
Beautiful, because I remember when they, in Florida, they have these mini tours, and they're all sponsored by different people, and I remember one time I was looking for a golf stat from the Hooters tour, and that Google led me to the place that I didn't expect to go.
I've been
on mini tours, by the way. I'm at the web.com tour event this week in Sarasota, Florida. Yeah, $550,000 up there, and you know, lots of times you think of the web.com tour as the place where young people are trying to make it. They're not always necessarily young, but you have Anel Cabrera was here and didn't make the cut, by the way. Mike Weir was here, did make the cut, 10 under, but those are two guys with major championships under their belt who are still trying to play for a piece of the pie at their age before they get to the Champions Tour. And they're here this week, and but the big news probably, and I don't know if you've covered this yet or not, but there was a golf professional from Naples named Ben DeArmond, and he works at the TPC Treviso Bay in Naples. He got a sponsor exemption. He was really excited to make his debut on the web.com tour. And when he got to the par 4 second hole, he hit his tee shot in the water, and then he put 5 more balls in the water and carded a 17. And he said, you know, I've heard people talk about nerves and golf. Now I believe it's true. It was the worst hole of his life. And he said he couldn't even get a 5-iron in the air when it started to go sideways like that. Now, we've all been there, right? The frustration mounts, the embarrassment mounts, the nervousness mounts. But he did recover, and he carded 10 of the last 11 holes, but finished in
I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I think he said, if I'm it was an out-of-body experience. Truly,
after two rounds of 16 under, J.T. Griffin, who was a Monday qualifier, and a guy called Maverick McNeely. So, I mean, if you're going to write a book about nature, you want characters called J.T. Griffin and Maverick McNeely, who aren't spring chickens either, but they're still out there trying to make it.
Oh, no, I know. I mean, they hit on the 63-65, J.T. Griffin did.
Thank you. running mostly in the digital media. I don't think it was on television. And was featured with some other women, young women, promoting the Apple Watch. And regardless of whether or not she accepted a nickel as a payment, that is a breach of the rules of amateur status, because she's trading on her celebrity, her skill as a golfer, and promoting a commercial product. It was immediately noticed by the USGA. And what was unusual about the situation is that it took about 6 weeks for the USGA to decide what they were going to do about that breach of the rules of amateur status. We're talking about a very talented young lady, a very likable young lady from Northern California. But nonetheless, she breached the rules of amateur status.
Can I just read the rule real quick? It says, quote, even if no payment or compensation is received, an amateur golfer is deemed to receive a personal benefit by promoting, advertising, or selling anything, or allowing his or her likeness to be used by a third party for the promotion, advertisement, or sale of anything. And that's pretty clear cut, don't you think?
That the young lady made a mistake. She eventually admitted to the mistake. She said she wouldn't do it again. She got a reprimand, and she retained her amateur status. And I've changed my mind. Through the process, I thought that she clearly did breach the rules of amateur status, and I thought that she should have her amateur status suspended for some period of time. But I now think that the USGA got this right. There's not a lot of high ground to be had if you're picking out a 15-year-old girl who says she didn't know any better. But I think where the USGA got it wrong was they should have suspended her amateur status immediately, because it was a clear violation, and then cause her and her family or her representatives to make the case that it was a mistake, that they didn't really understand the rules, they wouldn't do it again. Instead, what happened, apparently, and nobody really knows, and nobody's really ever done to know except those that were in the room, they allowed the family to kind of slow play this over a six-week period. And eventually, I think the USGA just tired of it and said, look, we're going to make a decision. We've got two choices. We can take away your amateur status, or we can reprimand you, and you'll agree that you violated the rules and you'll never do it again. And ultimately, it appears that that's what the outcome was. But I do think at the end of the day, they got it right. And it's unfortunate that we begin the new year, though, with an amateur status stuff like this.
Well, Andy Zhang got a warning when he did a video for, I think it was a family member promoting a golf club, and a USGA warned him. Is it necessary to give a warning to somebody else at the level of a celebrity of losing me for maybe the word to get out that this is something I'm not supposed to do?
Well, in Andy Zhang's case, when he realized that he had violated the rules of amateur status, he immediately called the USGA, immediately came clean, immediately apologized, and was given a warning. That didn't really happen with Lucy Lee and her family. They said that they couldn't cooperate with the USGA because of some sort of non-disclosure agreement that they had signed with Apple. And you get the idea that Apple wasn't too willing to cooperate with the USGA either. But at the end of the day, what the USGA came down on is precedent. There is ample precedent. In fact, I think a big body of work, if you will, on the precedent side that gave them the leeway to say, okay, if the player in question admits a mistake, apologizes, that in a first-time case like this, a warning or a reprimand is warranted. And once I began to understand the precedent nature that had been set by this and the vast body of precedent work, that's when I saw from my point of view and said, okay, I think they did the right thing here.
I see. Well, yes, I'm glad you filled me in on that, because I hear that a casting agent got in touch with her for an
incident could prompt the USGA to take a hard look at the rules of amateur status and how they exist and how they are applied in this modern age. When you have kids building their brand on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, not necessarily being paid for it, but nonetheless building a brand image in social media, that doesn't really square up with the rules of amateur status. And so I think this incident and probably some others are going to cause the USGA, now that they've gone through the rules revision, the big revision, to take a harder look at how we define amateurism in this modern digital age that we live in.
Now, what do you think about Tony Romo and his sketchers go down? He's an amateur.
Well, I saw the ad and I asked the question myself, and it is the belief of the USGA, and it's hard to disagree with this, that he's trading on his celebrity that was earned over a very long NFL playing career, and less so golf. Where it gets a little gray is he's promoting a golf product on a golf course and clearly talking golf. But it's hard to imagine that Tony Romo would be in that spot if he hadn't built the reputation that he had as a top-flight NFL quarterback and of late a really good broadcaster. So I think he gets a hall pass on this.
Yeah, I agree with you. I couldn't, feel bad about it. It's Tony Romo. Come on, guys. He's playing as an amateur golfer, but he's a celebrity. I mean, he's big. What bothers me is
that
it's all going away.
It has gotten its share of commentary out there, that's for sure.
With Lucy, I never thought of her as being an amateur because she has a powerhouse of a family behind her, so she has a lot of money behind her. And that's when you have that kind of wealth in your, in your brand, in your world, there are certain lines you don't think about. That's just de rigueur. This is just part of my world. This is what we do. And I think Lucy Lee can maybe be that example that needs to be set and say, hey, this isn't the right way to go about it. This is against the rules of amateurism. And all of you kids watching, this is a warning if she ever does it again. And at some point, do they then have to start being more strict?
Incumbent upon the player to understand the rules of golf. But that begs two questions. At what age is someone old enough to truly understand all of the rules of golf and their implications? And what if they come from a family that is not a golf family? I don't know a lot about Lucy's family, but I'm presuming that her mother is not a golfer. And so one wonders, did she understand fully the rules of amateur status and the various implications? And I think those are valid questions that can and should be asked. But I also think that the organization that I'm involved with, the American Junior Golf Association, and other junior golf associations around the world, probably need to do a little bit better job of, A, educating the players about not just the rules on the course, but the rules of amateur status off the course. And we need to do a better job of educating their parents or their legal guardians so that they fully grasp that they could make a bad decision and it could imperil their amateur status.
Yeah, and I think when I was talking about the rules of golf, I wasn't talking about the 5-6 game around or how you drop the golf ball. It's how you retain your amateur status. It takes so much when you become professional to become an amateur again. You go through a lot to get that amateur status back. And people, cherish having that amateur status. I'm so glad that I have this again. It's something to be proud of, to be an amateur. In the old days, the amateurs were the top players.
Related to Tiger Woods and accepted the money. he lost his amateur status. Now, it was a brief period. I think it was less than 2 years he was able to get reinstated. But even still, for 2 years, he technically was not allowed to compete as an amateur. You need to understand the ramifications of some of the decisions that you make. This guy, I think, did. He, $10,000 to $15,000 was worth it, apparently, to take 2 years off. But a 15-year-old girl with a promising career, I think she needed a little bit better counsel from the adults that are around her.
That's all we put. And you convinced me, that given the past history and the precedent that has been set, that, a warning is good. And thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate that.
Thank you for having me on today anytime.
Awesome. I'm Dr. Jim Nugent, founder and publisher of Global Golf Post. Go to globalgolfpost.com, and there's also Global Golf Post Plus. Check it out. I started reading one of the articles that was, and then I went, wait, is that, I have to sign in. I forgot to log in. The Golf Club is made possible by the great people at Centura Stone, Creative Plumbing, and Rainer Doors. Thank you so much. I love our power equipment. I want these largest power equipment showroom, two locations, Honolulu and Waipahu. Aloha Power Equipment. We put power at your fingertips. And with the weather we've been having, you never know what's going to happen. You want to have Aloha Power Equipment. Aloha extraction, when it floods, water or worse, the sewer pipes break, or mud inundates your home without water, call Aloha Extraction 24/7. They'll be on site in 90 minutes. 808-330-6212. That's AlohaExtraction.com. Creative Plumbing. Doesn't matter how large or small the project is, whether it's a new build, a renovation, or a repair, whether you want to redo the plumbing stack in your high-rise, or you want to work in your shopping center, call Creative Plumbing. It's got to be done right, and they do it right. Creative Plumbing. Got a boat fire, and you're trapped in traffic, and you need a better car? Hey, these cars are gently used. Go to Star Auto at 1450 South 13 next to Fulham. Star Auto, large selection, gently used cars. Star Auto, get your new ride. Futurezone's master craftsman, turning your project, your building, your warehouse. Do you know that you can make your warehouse floor look like marble? Have I told you that before and you didn't hear that? It's true. You walk into a car.